This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means we take a dive beneath the headlines, break down one of the biggest stories of the week. And this week,
I am so proud to be able to stand before you tonight as your Democratic nominee for governor of Massachusetts.
I am proud tonight to accept the Republican nomination to be your next governor of Massachusetts.
Snippets there of Maura Healey and Jeff Deal's victory speeches as they prepare to face each other in the general election for governor of Massachusetts. Healey has already tried to portray herself as the bipartisan, pragmatic option.
It's a choice between partisanship and progress, between dividing people and delivering for people.
While Deal has taken a bit of a different approach.
I declare Maura Healey to be the people's worst nightmare, and I'm here to stop her from ever bringing that radical policies to the governor's office.
So much to get into, as well as a number of other races and results with far-reaching implications. Joining us here in Studio 2 to help us break it down, former Boston City Councilor Anissa Esaibe-George. Anissa, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
It's great to have you. So lots of races, lots of issues. I do want to ask you first, though, primary's over. To you, what is the big headline from primary?
So I think that the biggest headline from Tuesday evening's preliminary primary election was the power that Maura Healey has in this state. And that power not only comes from her winning very clearly, and you know we saw that through the entire process, how clearly she was the front runner, especially on the Democratic side, and hopeful very much for that to follow through to November. But her picks, especially in her endorsement of Andrea Campbell, my former colleague on the Boston City Council, in her attorney general race, what power Maura Healey has in this state, I think that is, for me, the greatest takeaway. And one of the papers this week described it as a power shift here in state politics. I think that that's going to extend broader than just the state over the time, but that's the big takeaway for me.
So I do want to point out for listeners, so Andrea Campbell was running against Shannon Liss Reardon and Quentin Palfrey, although he pulled out prior to the actual primary day. And Elizabeth Warren, another big powerhouse Democrat, right? Senator Elizabeth Warren endorsed Liss Reardon, as did Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. So is that a piece of why you think this shows the power of Maura Healey and the shift? Because there were some other very strong Democrats who came down on a different side there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that was demonstrated in that race for sure. And in the final weeks, especially leading up to primary day, Maura really pulled out all the stops and lent her name and herself and her time to Andrea's race and getting the word out around how important this election was and how important primary day was. And you know, going back to Jeff Deal's comments around Maura being dividing and decisive. I think quite actually the opposite. Maura is someone who brings people together and really steps up to do the work. And on the Democratic side, some of her critics would say she's not radical enough. So to categorize her like that, I think is inaccurate for sure. Maura is, and I've endorsed Maura a long time ago, she is someone who truly will bring together people here in Massachusetts and serve the people of this great Commonwealth.
So let's hear a little more from her, actually.
I don't know about you, but I am tired of the anger, the vitriol, the division. That's not who we are. That's not what Massachusetts is all about. I want a different path. My path is one of optimism, working together with urgency and intention to get things done.
And I'm going to put that with another Jeff Deal cut, where he pitches himself as a balancing force.
Beacon Hill is going to pass a lot of extreme legislation if Maura Healey becomes governor. All those bills will get a hearing, and many of them will pass. As governor, I'll at least be a check and balance to a very extreme liberal legislature.
So a couple of things there, Anissa Esaibe-George. First, we have had mostly Republican governors in the last 20 or 30 years with a legislature that's been dominated by Democrats. Is there value to a balance there? So let's set aside Jeff Diehl's claims of providing that balance. We'll come back to Diehl and Healey in a minute. If Healey wins, as is expected, are you concerned about a lack of balance there for the state?
Not concerned about it at all. And Mara, through her experience, especially as serving as Attorney General, has seen the issues that are faced firsthand by people across the state and the impact her role as Attorney General has had on that work, especially as it relates and the way that I've been able to work with her in my professional capacity as a city councilor was through some of the work around the opioid crisis and supporting those suffering substance use disorder, the work around mental health and access to services. She is a champion for the issues that are so important, but knows and understands the work and how to get it done. And if we want that, certainly there's some value in that balance, but I believe she brings it. She's demonstrated that through her work as Attorney General.
So one more look at sort of the corner office race and the lieutenant governor race. And here is Democratic LG nominee Kim Driscoll, mayor of Salem for several years. What she said in her victory speech in the LG primary about the stakes.
The only way we move this Commonwealth forward is by defeating the MAGA Republicans who will force us backwards. Extreme Republicanism doesn't have a home in Massachusetts.
So I want to pull out two things there. First, reminding listeners that Jeff Diehl has been endorsed by Donald Trump. The Monday night, the night before the primary, Trump held a tele-rally mobilizing voters. At the same time, a new Emerson poll has Jeff Diehl getting 34% of the vote. That's a third of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And that's not a number to brag about.
Well, so say some more about that.
That's not a number to brag about. When we think about a breakdown that 66-34, whatever that poll showed, that's not a great number. And I'm hopeful that the Attorney General and her bid for governor will actually increase that spread quite a bit. I do want to say something.
Healey, just to be clear, 52% Healey, but only 12%
undecided. Right. So there's certainly some work to do there. And I am curious how, and I haven't seen this breakdown yet in the results from the other day, from the other evening, but where were there blanks on the ballot? Where is there room for growth? Where are people here in the Commonwealth feeling that there isn't a candidate that's talking to them today? And how do we make sure, and both camps will be looking at this, how do they connect with those voters and making sure that they show up in November, that they get to the polls and they vote? If I could just say something about Kim Driscoll, you know, earlier this year, I think in May or so, I had all of the LG on the Democratic side candidates over to the House for some meet and greets and some conversations. I've done this in a number of different races and ballot initiatives over the years.
Kim Driscoll, Eric Lesser, Tammy Gouveia.
Yes. And it was really fascinating to hear from all three of them and to understand their perspectives. None of them I really have known before, but what I think the public really appreciated about what Kim brought to the table and will bring to the table, and I say this as a former municipal elected official, is that city perspective, that sort of hyper-local work
Salem
that needs to
case.
Happen. Salem in this case, and being the mayor of Salem, and really understanding how cities and towns across the Commonwealth need to be reflected in the work that happens at the State House, because oftentimes you feel a disconnect from the work that happens up on Beacon Hill. So I think she'll really bring that to center stage. And, you know, the Attorney General, Mara Healey, as governor, hasn't had that hyper-local experience. So I think Kim creates a great balance for her in that.
So I want to use our last time here to talk a little bit about the Suffolk County DA's race. And I'll note for listeners that you endorsed Kevin Hayden, the current interim Suffolk County DA in that race. He did win the primary election on Tuesday. But where I want to focus is the disruption in the week before the primary at the Boston City Council and the sort of dividing of lines inside mostly Democrats around this issue. I'm going to play a little sound for you from Democratic strategist Susan Tracy talking to us last week about this race when we had her on the show.
How, as a city, we respond after this election, no matter which one of them gets elected, is going to be really important. Because if the anger that we are seeing in the city council and the anger that we are seeing on the streets in these campaigns continues post-Tuesday, that's a very bad thing for our city.
chaotic Boston City Council meeting last Wednesday, chaotic among the councilors and the crowd who eventually were shown out. And then there was scuffle, probably for lack of a better word, outside. You are a former Boston City Councilor. How did you react to that? And where do you see the imperatives for a functioning city leadership that can work together going forward?
Well, first, we've got to get beyond that. When I think about the capacity of a Boston City Councilor, whether a district councilor or an at-large member, the impact that they truly can have on the lives of Bostonians day in and day out. This week was the first week of school. Our kids returned to the Boston Public Schools into their classrooms. And there is an opioid crisis. There is some significant challenges and chaos en masse and cast, something that we've talked a lot about here over the last few years. And when we get wrapped up in these discussions, this fight, this anger and frustration, as Sue referenced it, we lose sight of the work that's so important to do for the people of Boston that need to send their kids to school, that need to deal with traffic, that need to understand, you know, the work that needs to happen around climate action, transportation issues. The T is shut down. Thousands of our kids are struggling to get to school today, and our, you know, workforce is trying to get into their offices every single day. Those are some very real significant problems that Bostonians are facing every day. And so this becomes, although an important discussion point, a distraction from the work. And the city council has tremendous impact on the daily lives of Bostonians. I am happy that there was no meeting today or this week. Let's say today's Friday with the holiday and election day. It throws the week off. So there was no council week meeting this week. I think that that break maybe will help cool some of the tempers, not remove some of the validity of the arguments that were made, but cool the tempers so that real work can happen.
All right. So, you know, 10-second answer, lots of serious stuff here, but the piece of you that's going to grab some popcorn and watch the general election now, what's the thing you're most interested in watching?
Well, first, I don't grab popcorn. I hate to be a spectator. I want to be actively engaged.
I'll be eating popcorn.
I think that that spread is really important to watch, that spread.
The
deal and Healy spread. And to make sure that we're closing that gap, that voters, residents across this Commonwealth feel engaged in this election.
All right. That is former Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George. Thank you for helping us dive beneath the headlines this week. And we're going to talk about the Boston Marathon bombing now. And we're going to hold those events and a crime that happened 2 years before those events up to the light. This conversation could be upsetting for some listeners, and we want you to know that now.
Initially, I was just investigating a triple homicide that took the life of my friend.
That is one of the first lines in a new documentary that premiered on September 5th from ABC News Studios and local independent journalist Susan Zalkind.
This investigation led me to the unsettling question. If police solved my friend's murder case, would they have prevented the Boston Marathon bombing?
The documentary is The Murders Before the Marathon, and it is an unsettling question. Here now to talk with us about it, Susan Zalkind, independent journalist and a producer of the documentary. Susan, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a lot to talk about here, but just for listeners, especially those who may not have been here at the time of the bombing, I'm just going to lay out a little bit of the timeline, Susan. The Boston Marathon bombing takes place April 15th. 2013. There's a multi-day manhunt across the city, people sheltering in place, ultimately the death of suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev during pursuit. Jahar Tsarnaev is taken into custody, later tried and convicted on 30 charges, has been sentenced to death. But you don't start there. You start on September 11th, 2011, and a triple homicide in Waltham that both stunned the region, I remember it when it came out in the paper, and ultimately hasn't been solved. One of the victims in that triple homicide was your friend, Eric Wiseman, who died alongside Brendan Mess and Raphael Tekin. So tell me, start with how this story, this triple homicide, comes into your life and what happens next.
Well, at the time, I was an aspiring crime beat reporter. I had just gotten out of college. I was at New England Cable News as a freelance overnight production assistant. And a strange story, an unusual murder, unlike any murder I've heard of in New England, certainly, cross the wire. Three men found stabbed to death, their throats slit, marijuana dumped on two of the bodies, and cash left behind. Now, this was horrific. It made me sick, but I was also an ambitious young reporter. I thought this maybe was a great story, and I began to look into it, and then
Oh, I lost your sound there. Then you found out.
Can you hear me now?
I can.
So then I found out that one of the victims was my friend, and my life screeched to a halt. You know, I still thought that this was a really unusual murder, unlike any murder I've heard of before. I think about the physicality required to stab three people, and why leave drugs and cash behind? But at the same time, I was also grieving the loss of my friend. I was scared.
So let's pick it up there. And I'm going to be mindful of, I want listeners to understand, your documentary lays out over 3 hours. I'm going to be making massive leaps forward in the story. For our, you know, 15-minute conversation, there's a lot more that we won't touch on. But at the heart of it, so you set out to investigate this as a journalist, and you lay out in the documentary the basic theory that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two marathon bombers, along with his friend Ibrahim Tadashev, were responsible for the Waltham murders. Briefly, how do you come to that?
Well, I began to devote my life to investigating this story after the Boston Marathon bombing, after Ibrahim Tadashev, who was an associate of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was shot to death in his own home after allegedly implicating himself and Tamerlan Tsarnaev in my friend's murder. The problem was that there was no information available about what actually happened. There were no answers coming from anyone in authority about what the connection was or was not regarding this triple homicide in Waltham and the connection to the Boston Marathon bombing. So It's been nearly 10 years since the bombing. It's been longer that I've been investigating this case. There still are no answers from anybody official.
So one of the things you made reference to was the death of Ibrahim Tadashev. And in the documentary, it becomes clear the FBI said that Tadashev had confessed to the murders as a drug deal essentially gone bad. There were redacted documents of his confession. You were able, sometimes people can literally get physically under the redaction and see what's underneath there. And you wind up seeing that Tadashev did in sort confess. Here's a little more from the documentary.
I'm waiting for 10 months.
Then the FBI and the Florida state prosecutor released their reports on Ibrahim Tadashev's death.
And I was able to remove the redaction from his handwritten confession.
Now, I want to point out, we did reach out to the Waltham police. We also reached out to Middlesex County DA's office looking for comment. We didn't hear back from them by our deadline. So you're now thinking, all right, this leads you then to this tough question. You essentially posit that failure, that you feel them as suspects, the failure to investigate them. How do you get from there to it could have prevented the Boston Marathon bombing?
Well, I had so many questions about why Ibrahim Tadashev was killed. I mean, even though I was able to find his handwritten confession, I confirmed that he had made these statements, but I had questions about what if he was coerced into saying that. I needed to find evidence outside of the documents that I was able to obtain via records request or court documents proving that Ibrahim Tadashev and Tamerlan Tsarnaev did it. This took me years. You said that Middlesex has not responded. I would love them to respond. Right now, where our focus is that we've won an appeal and a records request, and Middlesex is supposed to turn over all of their files in this case to the supervisor of records, and they haven't responded on that point either, though I am really hopeful that they will soon and that will comply with the order and turn over the documents.
But in the documentary, it does seem like you get a little bit from the Middlesex DA. You filed this records request. asking them to prove that they were really still investigating the crime. And here's a little bit from the documentary. This is the moment where you get your response from them on that, and you call another producer on the documentary, Matt Cook.
Hello?
Middlesex finally responded to my public records request.
Oh, what did they say?
They finally, after years, say on record that Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Ibrahim Tadashev are persons of interest in the murder investigation. And they say, in the past year, we have interviewed a material witness. That's one individual in the past year.
So one of the things that I have to ask you about, Susan, I hear frustration in your voice there. You talked about the fact that one of the victims was your friend. We have strong policies around conflict of interest in journalism, strong values around that. Do you have any concern that you're so close to this story that it was hard to report it objectively?
Well, I mean, that was one of the great things about teaming up with ABC News Studios. And one of my concerns in pursuing this story, it would have been fantastic if somebody else in the media pursued this case like I did. It would have saved me a lot of work and a lot of mental anguish. But the fact of the matter is that no one did. And there are no answers from law enforcement. These answers, this story should not have to come from me. I shouldn't have had to pursue this to get answers about a story involving national security.
So to that point, in 2015, Jahar Tsarnaev goes on trial for the Marathon bombings. The triple murder comes up in the sentencing phase because the defense wants it introduced into consideration, suggesting that Tamerlan Tsarnaev had undue influence on his brother. Here's a little bit from Boston Magazine editor-in-chief, former editor-in-chief, Carly Carioli.
Jahar's defense was arguing that they should be able to get evidence that the government had about the Waltham murders. So if the defense could prove that Jahar was under the influence of his older brother, then that might be something that would be the difference between him getting life in prison and being handed a death sentence.
Ultimately, it wasn't allowed. Then in 2020, the First Circuit Court of Appeals says Tsarnaev didn't get a fair trial. Later, the government appeals it to the U.S. Supreme Court, who just back in March basically says he did and ruled 6-3 to reinstate the death penalty for Tsarnaev. Am I understanding that that piece is why you are suggesting that if the triple murder in Waltham in 2011 had been pursued differently, the Boston Marathon bombings might not have happened?
There's so much information in the docu-series essentially proving that case. I think also if you talk about my frustration, this was 8.5 years for Middlesex to release a statement identifying Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Ibrahim Tadashev by name in connection to the Waltham murder case. That's 8.5 years that it's taken for them to at least address that there is a potential connection between the Boston Marathon bomber and this open homicide. Now, you have the story of this complicated path this case has taken through the bombing trial and up to the Supreme Court, but you also have another issue that if Middlesex admits that Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Ibrahim did it, we have to look at an uncomfortable truth, which is, had Tamerlan Tsarnaev been arrested for murder, that the Boston Marathon bombing may never have happened. Now, I would love to hear more about what their investigation looked like before the bombing and after the bombing, because the opportunity that I think has been missed, we're approaching the 10-year marker of the Boston Marathon bombing, is to at least review what happened.
So, Susan, again, 3-hour documentary, so much here. It feels like a lifetime over the years of the details of this. And, you know, people can dive in further. My last question to you before I let you go, just briefly, there's a book coming. This documentary is out. Will you turn this over now? Is this the end of the line for you, the final salvo, or is this just the beginning?
I don't really know how to put this down. We're fighting an active records request appeal. We're hoping for more information from the Middlesex County District's Attorney, and I think now is the time to to keep pushing for answers and accountability.
Susan Zollkind is an independent journalist and one of the producers of the new ABC News Studios documentary, The Murders Before the Marathon. The documentary is available to stream on Hulu. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Nolan is a former Boston Police Department lieutenant, a longtime criminal justice professor, including at Boston University and Tufts University. He was also in the documentary, The Murders Before the Marathon. He's here in Studio 2. Tom, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So this is a hard conversation. The Boston Marathon bombing sits in our bones so deeply. And you are someone who knows law enforcement but has also criticized law enforcement in analysis over the years. How do Susan's allegations sit with you?
Well, I think the tactics and the strategies that were employed by law enforcement who was assigned to the Middlesex DA's office in going to Florida.
This is for the Ibrahim Tadashev.
This was to interview Tadashev in 2013 following the marathon bombing. I think there were some missteps there in their travel down there and in information that we don't know that they had in interviewing Tadashev and then interrogating him. Subsequent to that, they informed him of his Miranda rights. At some point, they made some tactical decisions that I would call into question. Number one being agreeing to going to Tadashev's apartment to conduct the interrogation there instead of at a police facility. Now, Tadashev had been at a police facility in Orlando a few weeks earlier and was questioned by some task force members about his possible awareness involvement with the marathon bombing. They went a second trip some 2 weeks later where they agreed to go to Tadashev's apartment to conduct this interrogation. When they went there, Tadashev asked them to take their shoes off, and an FBI agent and two Massachusetts State Police troopers agreed to do that. And they went in and interrogated him for almost 5 hours. And at the conclusion of that interrogation, Tadashev began to implicate himself and his friend Tamerlan Tsarnaev in the triple homicide in Waltham. And he began to write a confession as to his involvement in the triple homicide. During that time, something occurred where an allegation was made by the one state police officer who was in the apartment with the FBI agent that Tadashev suddenly attacked the FBI agent, and the FBI agent, suffering a wound to his head wound, drew his weapon and fired 7 times, striking Tadashev and killing
him. Ultimately killing him. And your sense is that there was a lot that just wasn't standard operating procedure about that entire experience, from
exactly.
The shoes to the being at home to the killing, et cetera. So I want to, and again, we're now talking with a former law enforcement officer and criminal justice professor Tom Nolan about the new documentary, The Murders Before the Marathon. We don't have a lot of time. What I really want to ask you is, The thesis here is a causal chain. Mistakes and failures around the investigation of the Waltham triple murders in 2011 potentially led to the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013 by failure to prevent. Do you find that a plausible argument?
It's a fair question to ask. From the early stages of the investigation following the 2011 triple homicide, the resources that should have been devoted to this investigation, this should have been the number one priority of the Middlesex DA's office, was to investigate and bring to a conclusion, identify suspects in this triple homicide, and that didn't happen. This investigation faded from the spotlight very quickly in a matter of weeks, and it became, for whatever reason, a relatively low priority. There was one state police trooper who was assigned to the DA's office to investigate this. This should have been something that that was given the highest priority and the resources necessary to bring the investigation to a conclusion. That didn't happen. And in the intervening period, fast forward to 2013, we had the marathon bombings occur. Following that, the law enforcement made a determination that they had some suspects in the triple homicide going back to 2011, and they began to move forward on it only after the bombings had occurred.
So what about the argument that Johar Tsarnaev could have certainly acted alone, that there were two people at the Boston Marathon bombing? Tamerlan Tsarnaev was implicated in 2011, but not Johar.
Yes. So I think it's fair to speculate, and we could go back and forth on this, but the likelihood of the younger Tsarnaev carrying out the bombings himself, I think that's unlikely that that would have occurred. I think representations were made during his trial that his older brother was the mastermind behind the bombings. And had he been taken out of commission, had he been arrested for his involvement in the triple homicide, I think a fair question is asked as to whether or not the marathon bombings would have occurred.
So we have to ask hard questions about painful times. That's really a lot of what, having watched this documentary, that's really a lot of what's going on here, is asking really painful questions about very painful times. You and Susan Zalkind both seem to have come to pretty close to the same conclusions. And my question is, should we embrace those conclusions? What do we do with that now?
Well, what do we do with it? Is it part of the healing process? I think that collectively our psyche here, in not just in the Boston area, but in New England, was badly damaged in the aftermath of the bombings. Does this somehow bring us some kind of resolution? I'm not sure. I think what it does is call for some tough questions to be asked, and certainly directed at the Middlesex District Attorney's Office as to why they proceeded in the fashion that they proceeded in investigating these triple homicides. And I think my sense is that had they done what they should have done in following the necessary investigatory steps to bring this investigation to a conclusion, the evidence, the leads were out there for the police to pursue, and they didn't pursue it. And as a result, we're having the conversation we're having today, unfortunately.
All right. And just again to note, we did reach out to the Middlesex DA's office for comment, and they didn't respond to us in time for our deadline. Tom Nolan is former Boston Police Department lieutenant, a longtime criminal justice professor. We've been talking about the documentary, The Murder Before the Marathons. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Like it or not, summer is wrapping up, which means football season is here again. And the New England Patriots kick off their season on Sunday night in Miami against the Dolphins. And if you're not a football follower, the beginning and the end of the season against Miami last year, not pretty. And then, oh, you got the Red Sox. Good Lord.
Burbanks comes ready. Here's the first pitch. Breaking ball whacked into the air. Shallow right. Long way to run for Margot. He's still coming in. Now he'll get there to make the catch, and the Rays win.
A combination shutout in a 1-0 victory. Rays go to 5-1 on the homestand. They allow 10 runs for the entire homestand.
Oh, that stinks.
Ouch. That's right. And that's Chris Siderick from WBUR here in Studio 2. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to do a sports thing here. And we're also asking Jonathan Marshall to join us, sports reporter from WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. Jonathan's on the line. Jonathan, welcome to Radio Boston.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Was that hard to listen to?
Was it hard to listen to?
Yes.
As somebody who covers the Boston sports teams, you always want to, you know, enjoy the teams that you're covering. I'm a Philly sports guy, though, so it's not that hard to take in. I gotta be honest with you.
I can't believe you dropped that 30 seconds into the segment. That's bold.
Look,
that's bold.
I'm gonna just put it out there. Let it be known. This is what it is. But I'm gonna be unbiased in my, you know, critiques of the teams.
All right. So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna start with the New England Patriots, and we're gonna help all our listeners, those who love football and those who don't know it, get ready for this season opener. So, Jonathan, the team's trying to run a new offense this year, and there has been, I think we could fairly say, some coaching drama. We've got quarterback Mac Jones. He's in his second season. There's some mixing up happening. For folks who may just be tuning in now, give us a sense, where is the team at going into this first game?
I don't think anybody knows where this team is. We don't even know who's calling the plays. How are the plays being set down? If you watch the preseason performance from this offense, the first team offense specifically, it just seems like there's no continuity on the O-line. There's no sustained drives. It looks confusing. And when you have a guy like Matt Patricia and Joe Judge, as far as just offensive collaboration, Bill Belichick is saying it's all on me. There's multiple voices. And I'm concerned for a young quarterback in Mac Jones, who already had Josh McDaniels last year, and now he has two new voices this year. For him to be in his second year, you want to have some sort of continuity. I'm not seeing it.
Okay.
And so what to expect from this team in week one? If it's based off the preseason performance, I wouldn't expect too much, honestly. It may take a few weeks to really get things settled in.
Yeah, that's a little discouraging. So, Chris, let's break this down. So, John just basically tells us offense is playing differently from last year, and you made reference to these two guys, Jonathan, who are essentially supposed to be the offensive play whisperers. Break that down for us, Chris.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the Patriots for about 20 years have run the same style offense, and now they are switching it up. And they're doing that with two guys, Matt Patricia and Joe Judge, who are not offensive coaches. So to me, the way to think about it is if you're a line cook and you've worked in an Italian restaurant for 20 years, you know how to make a real good dish of pasta.
Yep.
Now somebody comes in and says, okay, we're now a sushi restaurant. And the guys that are going to teach you how to make sushi are usually the guys that do the interior design of the restaurant, right? They don't even know how to cook. That's the level we're dealing with here. And it makes no sense for a guy like Bill Belichick to come into the season with no real veteran voices on the coaching side beyond his own.
So Jonathan Marshall, pick up on that. Is Chris's analogy fair?
No, it's on point. It's on point. If you know the background of Matt Patricia being a defensive guy, like, how is this going to work? And it shows on the field. There's no continuity. It just seems like nobody knows what's going on. There's multiple voices. Like, what is the process on game day going to be like? You know, and so it's very concerning, and it shows. It seems like a lot of guys are frustrated on the field. The offense isn't moving how you would expect a playoff team to be moving. This was a playoff team last year, and from the looks of it in preseason, it's not looking like it. And it's they're in the danger zone because if you pay attention to the NFL, if you watched last night's game, the Buffalo Bills are looking like legit contenders. Miami Dolphins got better. The Jets are still the Jets, but still, you don't want to take them for granted. And so when it comes to the Patriots and the AFC East, those days of dominating that division, of course, are over because Buffalo are the kings of that division. But Miami is a team that has had their number. So this week one matchup is going to be a huge test to see where this team is at. And so New England is in a very, very dangerous area when it comes to even just being in playoff contention. So they need to get it together quickly.
Philly fan loving dancing on the Patriots. Great. Real nice.
And for listeners, the halcyon days are probably over for a while at this point. All right, I do want to go to, and I say this with great sincerity, the dumpster fire that is the Boston Red Sox. And Jonathan, I'll stay with you for a second longer on this. Last year, the team almost made it to the World Series. How can one team fall so far so fast?
That's a good question. This season is over. Let me just put that out there. They're 10 games back in the wild card race, so we could just put this season to bed. But I mean, obviously there are injuries. There are a lot of things that happen within the course of a season, right? And so I think the Red Sox have a long off season ahead, a very important off season, some big decisions to make. And so I think they have to shore up that pitching, the bullpen. Like that's the main issue. And so those are the biggest things that stand out to me about this year's Red Sox team.
I feel like there's also a clubhouse issue here in that, Tiziana, you and I have talked before about ownership kind of setting the tone for a team, right? When the trade deadline comes, if they make a couple moves to try to bring in some talented players, it sends a message to the players, hey, these guys believe in us. They think we're right there on the edge. And I think ownership has basically sent the opposite message to these guys. It's we're going to ship guys out. We're going to cheap it out. We're not going to spend a lot of money. We're not going to try to compete this year. And your players respond accordingly.
So, I'm just going to end it there because that is so depressing as a baseball fan. And I want to get to Jonathan. I want to pick up on this theme that Chris just gave of ownership and the signals they're sending to their players, because we had a very exciting season with the Boston Celtics, almost made it to the very pinnacle. And in the offseason, there's been some kerfuffle, let's be honest, about the signals that ownership are sending to the team. We got just a couple of minutes here. Cap that off for us.
Yeah. You know, I know a lot of the pressing takes about the Patriots and Red Sox, right? But, you know, the Celtics, I think, are a team that Boston fans can believe in. I do like the moves that they've made. Malcolm Brogdon, getting Malcolm Brogdon this offseason is going to be such a huge, huge piece, specifically for guys like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, just lessening the load on those guys as far as being playmakers and having to handle the ball so much. I think Malcolm Brogdon is a guy who's really going to can take that team to the next level. And so Brad Stevens has shown that he knows what he's doing. He knows when it comes to personnel and putting an actual team together that can compete and making a cohesive unit. I love what Brad Stevens has done, even with the hiring of Coach Ime Udoka. And so
Brad Stevens is the corner office guy.
Yeah, so I think Brad Stevens, as far as him being in the front office, I think Boston is really on the right track. And so ownership, when it comes to the Celtics, they're on the right track. This is a cohesive unit. They can compete when it comes to trying to compete for a championship.
They can definitely compete. Jonathan, I'm wondering what you think of the Jaylen Brown trade rumors that came out. It was kind of floated out that the team was basically taking calls, seeing if they wanted to trade Jaylen Brown, who's arguably their second best player. Maybe their most consistent player, especially.
That might depress me, Jonathan.
Well, he seemed to really react on Twitter pretty negatively to it. Do you think that impacts his play at all?
I think, look, it's Kevin Durant, right? I think almost every single team is going to inquire about a guy like Kevin Durant, one of the best scorers we've ever seen play ever, right? And so for a guy like Jaylen Brown, you can look at it two ways, right? Yes, I'm offended. Why am I in trade rumors? I'm having probably one of the best years of my career. We made it to the finals. Why would we even try to mess this up? But also, it's Kevin Durant. My name is being mentioned in the same breath as Kevin Durant in trade talks, right? And so I think for Jaylen in Boston, it's like, look, it comes down to it. When his contract is up, what is the likelihood of him even re-signing? And so for Boston, it's a business decision at the end of the day, right? And so for Jaylen, I don't think it would be too big of a thing for him, honestly. I think he knows it's a business at the end of the day. He's a veteran. He's been in this league for years. He knows how it works. And so for me, it's a situation where it's like, okay, hey, you know, let's focus in. Let's lock in.
Yeah, I mean, especially if he's going to be out of here in 2 years when his contract's right up, then that means the window is a lot shorter than we maybe thought it was at first.
And so thinking long-term for Jaylen Brown, if you perform, if you focus, if you lock in, that's going to do better for your next contract. And wherever that may be, it may not be in Boston, but he understands that it's a business. I think he'll lock in and focus in this season. I don't envision this being a major thing when it's actually time to tip off.
All right. Jonathan Marshall is sports reporter for WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. Jonathan, you're going to come back on Monday. We're going to see what happened over this weekend and maybe do some more prognostication, correct?
We are, and Patriots fans, it's just 1 week. Don't go overboard. You know, I don't know what to expect. We'll see what happens, but it's just 1 week, so give it some time.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for joining us today. We'll talk to you again on Monday for the wrap-up.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
All right, Chris Siderick, you're still here in studio, and I am going to have you stand by because...
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
It is the weekend. It's the time when we look at what gets done in the city over the next few days. And in the region, we bring in WBUR senior arts and culture reporter Cristela Guerra. And I didn't want you to miss the fun. Cristela, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you. Okay, so what are you most excited about this weekend for you personally?
Oh, my goodness.
Besides the Patriots game, obviously.
Right. Oh, very. I mean, yeah. Football. yes. So it's honestly the first on my list, and I really want to go see it.
Okay, tell us.
There is a public art project. I'm going to pronounce this my best. Tuhmahraditipi. It's a Dakota word for beehive, and it's by an artist, Erin Genia, who is Dakota, and it's a sculptural project for bees and insects. And I guess the idea is to sort of celebrate that environment. It celebrates indigenous science. It offers an opportunity for showing the role of pollinators in plants. And I think especially now where the season is changing, but we've still got a bit of summer left, I think it's going to be stunning. And she was also part of the 2021 Artery 25 cohort. So,
tell listeners what the Artery 25 cohort was.
It is our incredible annual celebration of artists throughout Boston, especially emerging artists that are doing things that people need to keep an eye on.
All right. And Chris, are you afraid of bees?
I am actually allergic to bees.
Oh, don't go
but,
to this.
No, I know, right? I'm like, oh, that is my nightmare. But they do play such an important part in the ecosystem. Like, that sounds really striking, too. It's cool.
I think so go the bees, so go our world.
And this is at the Rose Kennedy Greenway, and it goes for a while,
right? It does. It's until December, and it's free.
All right, so now we've got something for writers. Tell us about that, Cristela.
We do. So tonight, 6 o'clock to 7:30 p.m. in the Seaport, it's a workshop called Write Together, Collaborative Storytelling by Grub Street. It's free, and you're there to create stories based on certain prompts. Folks must be vaccinated against COVID, but generally I think folks can show up, register, show up, and try and participate.
And that's at 6 o'clock tonight, is that right?
6 this evening.
And so it's literally collaborative writing with total strangers.
Yeah.
That sounds a little intimidating.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah. Have you ever done anything like that, Cristela?
I have. More around poetry, but yes.
Yeah, I have never done that. That does sound a little... But it does sound cool, too, especially if this is your jam. All right. So give us something else. And this one, I think you're taking us to Newtonville next, right?
Yeah. So Newton Theater Company, they're presenting No Child by Nalaja Sun. It's Saturday at 8 o'clock. It's at St. John's Episcopal Church in Newtonville, as you said. And Sun is going to play every role in the show. So wow. Teachers, students, and like in this clip, a janitor.
Now, I think I know what you're thinking. I know about the public schools. I watch Eyewitness News. What I got to say today? Hush. You don't know unless you've been in the schools on a day-to-day basis. Hush. You don't know unless you've been a student, administrator, teacher, or... custodial staff, hush. Because you could learn a little something.
So that sound, I think, comes courtesy of WNED in Buffalo, and where there was another performance of the play. I listened to that, Cristela, and honestly, it's fascinating, but it sounds exhausting to be one person who has to slide in and out of so many other people's realities in such rapid succession.
Absolutely. It's a pop-up show, so I think if folks want to catch it, it's a one night only. Tickets are $25. And I think to your point, I mean, she's playing a teacher in a Bronx public school who's putting on a play for her students. And they're 10th graders. And I'm imagining all the teachers going back to school now.
Right.
I think it's going to be pretty powerful.
And you were a teacher. How much does it take to, Chris, to be alive, well, and strong with students?
I mean, it takes everything. And it is both one of the most rewarding and challenging jobs I've ever worked in my life, definitely. But to hear that kind of passion is really powerful.
So, Cristela, Brimfield Fair, which I'm a little bit excited about. The TV show Flea Market Flip has been shot there in the past. I may or may not have watched a couple episodes. Tell us about the Brimfield Fair.
My mother has tailored trips around catching Brimfield.
Wow.
Like, she loves Brimfield. They call themselves the America's oldest outdoor flea market. It is massive. It is like a city. This is the third and final fair. It started on Tuesday at 6 a.m. and it goes until Sunday at 3 p.m. And I think most areas, gates, like they're free. You know, you go in there and you find anything and everything that you could possibly fathom when it comes to vintage or antiques.
So anything from something inexpensive, kind of flea markety, to like valuable antiques.
Very nice furniture. I mean, folks, like, I think prepare for this all year to sell all kinds of items.
And a little bit of trivia back on the Flea Market Flip. So Nancy Kerrigan, actually, her episode of Flea Market Flip was shot there. It aired in 2018, and her team went against a team led by Olympic judo gold medalist Kayla Harrison. So it was kind of interesting to have our two local Olympians go head-to-head at Flea Market Flip.
Hmm.
All right, so are you going to Brimfield this weekend?
I might swing by.
All right. Cristela Guerra is WBUR senior arts reporter and our guide to the best of Greater Boston this weekend. Cristela, thanks.
Thank you.
And Chris Siderick from WBUR, thanks for staying with
thanks
us.
Thanks for letting me crash the party. Always
absolutely
great.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. We had help today from Rob Lane. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.